Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network. I'm your host, Fran Lewis, and I am totally excited because Jessica Barry is here, and the novel is Free Fall. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Glad that you're there. I was getting worried that you're calling
you
in from England. Yeah, I can hear you. From England, I'm
okay,
like,
good.
Oh, my God. I have to tell you.
Here.
I know. And HarperCollins is closed today, and I'm going, oh, my God. So this book was sent to me as a present from Heather, a nice present, and I was presently surprised. This book is fantastic, really. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
And I have two copies of it, and somebody already took the other one. So how did you decide the storyline in two separate voices, Allison and Margaret? She is in a plane crash, and her fiancé is dead. And how did you decide that you were going to do this from two different points of view, from a mother and a daughter that really are not that close?
Yeah, the decision to do the two voices came a little bit later for me. So I kind of had the idea of this woman being in a plane crash and surviving. That was the kind of like first idea I had. And then I wanted there to be an element of somebody playing detective. Like I wanted her, you see that she's in the plane crash and you don't know what's happening with her or why she was in the plane. And I wanted there to be somebody who was like in the real world trying to figure out what had happened to her. And it actually, like, I was on honeymoon with my husband, actually, and we were talking about it over dinner one night, and it was his idea. He was like, oh, what about if it should be her mother? And I was like, that's the best idea I've ever heard. So it's really,
well,
that's where
cool.
It came from. And it made a lot more sense, because originally I was like, I wanted it to be somebody who was close to her. And I think that the idea of a mother finding out all this stuff about her adult daughter, it like really opened up a lot of possibilities.
It certainly did, seriously. And maybe I need to ask my husband to help me with my next idea too. That would help.
I mean, it's a hit and miss process,
yeah,
I have to say.
Great. I know, that is great. So why did Margaret have a certain amount of resentment? I read this and I read the flashbacks, and what was really interesting was that they were like double flashbacks. It was like Allison had her flashbacks into what happened in the accident, then she talks about her father and their relationship, and then Margaret has her own perception of what happened. I got that part.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay. Allison was, you know, very precocious, and Margaret resented her as a child. Why is that? That she really was, and she was close with her father, and yet her mother wasn't thrilled about it.
Yeah, I think that happens. I mean, I don't know if she, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about her being resentful of it, but I guess she kind of was. And I think
that
I think that happens sometimes where a kid is closer to one parent, than the other. And I think that I wanted to imagine what that would feel like for the parent who isn't in that little bubble. You know, I think that there can sometimes be, I can see how it would lead to a feeling of, if not resentment, certainly kind of feeling left out and feeling like you weren't in on the joke, you know, or in on the gang. And so that was something that I thought would be interesting to explore.
Well, it was because I was closer to my father too, growing up.
Interesting.
And I think, I was, and I think my mother was tougher on me than anybody else. So maybe
yeah,
I don't think she didn't resent me, but she just expected a brilliance out of me every single day. So
yeah.
The novel begins with an accident that really defines free fall as a downward move in toward, you know, with gravity. And it just keeps going down, 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 which is the part of the plane that I can't stand when they descend. The novel begins with the accident. Why did you create this first scene? And how do we know from the start, which they found amazing, that Allison didn't get killed? And her survival skills, where did she learn that? That was really great.
Oh, thanks. Well, I wanted to, I think that because she grew up in Maine, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I wasn't outdoorsy at all. My family is not outdoorsy. We're not campers, but I knew a lot of people who were outdoorsy. I think that there is a kind of tradition of outdoorsiness in New England, particularly in Maine, because you have mountains and stuff. And so a lot of her knowledge came from her father, from camping with her dad when she was younger. And so she was able to kind of then draw on that when she was suddenly in the Rockies with very little food and water and very little shelter. So that's kind of, she was like relying on the knowledge that she had as a kid. And then I think another part of it is just instinct. You know, I think that either, you know, there is an element of instinct that has to kick in when something like that happens. It either kicks in or it doesn't. And the inspiration for the book and for Allison's, like, for the crash and for Allison's kind of journey through the wilderness was that I read this article a few years ago about this teenage girl who was on a similar kind of small plane, and it crashed in Washington State, I think, and her grandparents were flying the plane. I think there were only three of them on the plane, and her grandparents were killed in the crash, and she survived and ended up walking for 2 days and two nights through the woods of Washington State until she hit a road and managed to flag down a car. And so that was like that idea, like that somebody could have that determination and instinct to survive was really interesting to me.
That was interesting to me too, because every time she didn't have enough water, I was getting thirsty. Seriously.
Yeah.
And when she didn't have
really?
Enough food, I'm going like, I'm not going to eat for you, Allison. I don't know how anybody, you know, my God. I think the water is more important than anything else, and she was lucky that there was anything on the plane at all. So,
yeah,
the flashbacks
absolutely.
With her father that was unreal. So the flashbacks with her father gives us insight into her youth. Why did he teach her how to shoot a gun and understand how to stay alive? And how did you create these scenes? And you know, with Allison. Of course, it was almost, I'm reading the book and I'm saying, like, this is how, I feel like it was happening right then and there.
Oh, good. Oh, thanks. Well, I think that he taught her those kind of survival skills I think that there is a kind of vein of hard scrabble-ness that happens with people from New England, where there is this idea of like, you don't necessarily do things the easy way all the time. And there's like value in doing things the hard way. So, a friend of mine grew up in a house where they had, like a wood burning oven in the basement, and that heated their entire house rather than having central heating. And he and his brother and his dad would go out and they would chop wood they chopped so much wood. And I think that there was like a thing about like, I'm sure that they could have, you know, they could have had central heating. They could have done something differently rather than, and they could have bought the wood already chopped. But instead it was this idea of like, there was this value in doing it yourself and instilling that in your kids. And I think that was Allison's father's motivation for passing those skills on. And I like the idea of a father passing those skills on to his daughter as well, because I think that sometimes you think about that being a kind of father-son thing. And I liked the idea of it being a father-daughter activity as well.
I agree. My father was, I was his partner in crime. Whenever he needed something done that he didn't want my mother to know about, he would, you know, he would call me just, this is what I need you to do. And then 10 minutes later, I said, why did you tell her what you told me to do? You told on me.
Yeah.
And then she would say to me, did you write that for him? I go, it's too late. I mailed it. Tough. You're not getting it. And it's like, she doesn't judge you have a sample on your computer. I go, no, I deleted it. Sorry. I mean, she got me in, oh, my God, he got me in. And I used to crack up laughing, though. So Margaret learns that Allison is in a crash, and they're not very close. So what was her reaction, and why was she really upset, and how come she tried to actually find her? She was determined. I mean, she used her library skills and everything. That was really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the her first reaction was just grief, like that when – her first reaction was that she's told that her daughter is dead, and there's just this kind of desolation that overcomes her. And it's really the thing that ends up driving her is this like hope that maybe she's not dead. And even if she is dead, this hope of maybe she can figure out what happened. And I think that that was, for Maggie, like, that was really important. It was almost, it was a kind of part of her grieving process, really. Like, I think that even if, I mean, obviously Allison was alive, so she was right, but I think even if Allison had been killed in the crash and her body had later been found, I think that Maggie still would have gone through this process of trying to, like, hunt down the truth, because it was her way of, like, repairing the damage and bridging the gap between the two of them.
It's sort of like she was felt guilty, and now she didn't want to feel guilty anymore about how she feels. I felt about Allison. So she
I think that
took
right.
on another role. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was like her way of like, this is the only way I can help my daughter. Like, I haven't been there for the, like, you know, we haven't been in touch for the past couple of years. This is the way that I can now, you know, be close to her again.
Well, we're not going to tell anybody that's listening if it's the truth or not. So how did you come up? This title got me, because, I mean, Heather sent me the book, and I go, okay, and what is this about? And I'm looking at the, you know, the interview that you did with somebody else, and I'm looking at something, and wait a minute, I got to read this. And anybody that knows me knows that I'm a speed reader, but I read every word in the book, as you can tell. And I just sat down and read. I don't do that too often. I just sat down and said, okay, I'm just going to sit down and read this. And then she emailed me and she said, did you read it yet? I go, I got it 5 minutes ago. Seriously. And, yeah. So how did you come up with a title which makes total sense, Free Fall?
Well, I can't take credit for it. It was my agent. My brilliant agent, Felicity, came up with it. And we went back and forth about titles forever. I'm really not very good at coming up with titles for my books. Like, I'm struggling now to figure out a title for my new book. So it's not really my forte, but Felicity's very good at it. And my original, like, kind of working title for the book was After the Fall, which is like a similar kind of connotation to it. But when she said free fall to me, I was like, that's perfect, because it captures the idea of, you know, the plane falling out of the sky, but also this idea of, you know, two people whose lives are in very different ways in free fall. It was an immediate yes for me.
So in other words, because I've never done this before, my new book, I hope it comes out very soon, someday soon. I actually send it to a regular publisher, and they're actually reading it, and I don't know if they like it. I guess it takes a while before they decide. And I did tell the person that I rewrote it, because I was given some great hints by one of the New York Times authors, that I said, could you read this, please? And they did. And I, you know, changed
it.
Yeah.
Great.
The title is Silent Voices, and it's told from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone that did something wrong, but somebody put them there. It's different.
Ooh.
But I guess when you write a book, yeah, it's different. I wrote four of them, and this is the fifth one. It's like, it's scary, but sometimes you get angry and you just want to kill somebody off in your book, and it's great. But I'm wondering, So in other words, if you didn't like the title Freefall, they have the final say as to the title, the publishing company, they decide?
No, it's like a collaborative thing. So, I mean, sometimes they'll, sometimes you'll come, you'll bring them a title and they'll be like, yeah, that's great. Love it. Hooray. And other times they'll say, ah, I'm not sure. And then you've got to go through a whole process where you toss ideas around. It's like they, I don't think that, I mean, just speaking from my own experience, like I don't think that they can just say now the book is called this. Like there has to be, like it has to be in consultation. But they want to. There will often be a discussion about what the best title is for the book in terms of like marketability and all that kind of stuff. It's a whole.
You're lucky because I've spoken to, I interviewed some authors last week that said that they had no say in the title of their book. They decided for them, and they came up with something, and they came up with something else. So it depends, I guess, on the publishing company and the agent.
Yeah.
And I'm looking. I mean, I'm looking at the cover, and I'm saying, okay, this makes sense because there's like little things falling down.
Yeah. I know the cover is really cool. I was really happy with that. I think they did a good job.
It's different. So let's get to the Ben and his relationship with Allison. Why did he take to her? And I got to know him, and I'm not going to say whether I liked him or not, but oh well, what can I say? So he was in the plane crash. And what was his real relationship with her? I mean, she's a wonderful person, and yet I don't know about him.
Yeah, I think that, but I think, I mean, we all know people who are nice people who end up with people who are not so nice.
Yeah, I know.
I think that that is sadly a very common refrain. I think that, to be honest, like, I think that he saw that she was like a wounded bird, like she was like a wounded little animal, and saw an opportunity there. Like I think that he wanted there. I think that there are people in this world who are drawn to damaged people, and I think that he is one of those people. He's somebody who, like, and not in a way that he was like, oh, I want to fix you. It was like, oh, I guess you're at a place in your life where I can control you. And so I think that's really his kind of MO.
That came out loud and clear.
Oh, good.
And I think that, you know what, I don't know if I put this in my review that I posted. I just posted your link to Amazon on my Facebook wall and everywhere else in the planet. But I think that young girls need to know this. This is a very important issue that people need to know, that when you meet somebody and they start developing your life and controlling it and planning it how they think you should live, you need to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Absolutely.
That's a red flag. So how does Margaret use her librarian and researcher to learn more about the accident? And she really wants to learn the truth. So how does she use her skills as a librarian and researcher? I love doing research. It's fun. To find out the truth about what happened to Allison. She's got access, more access than most people would.
Yeah, exactly. So she has access to all these databases through, she used to work at a college library in Maine. And so she goes back to her old college library and talks to her friend. And the friend kind of sets her up on a computer and gives her the kind of university logins for these things. And so she's able to access things like the flight report, because every time there's a plane crash, they do a kind of accident report. You have to, I guess, who would it be? I guess like the Flight Association do like a kind of report on what happened, and a kind of investigation. So she looks into that. She looks into Facebook to try to figure out what her daughter was up to. She like scans the local news out of San Diego, which is where her daughter was based. So she uses quite a lot of her kind of like sleuthing, her internet sleuthing skills to figure out what's going on. And I think that, the idea is that she's just like this dog with a bone. She's just incredibly determined and tenacious. And I think that, you know, any good researcher is like that. You know, they won't stop until they feel like they've fully found out what's happened and found out the truth. And she's definitely applying that when she's trying to find out what's happened to Allison.
I agree. And as a matter of fact, when I read historical fiction or history, I constantly look up what the author's trying to say and what the author has researched to see if it's accurate. I'm terrible. I do that. And,
That's like part of the pleasure of it, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's, I think, like, really good historical fiction, like, it can, it teaches you along the way, you know?
It certainly does. I just interviewed Douglas Preston last week for Verses of the Dead, and I learned a lot about the cemeteries and a whole bunch of things that he taught me over the phone. And then I interviewed Vincent Zandria, and we talked about the publishing industry, which I did some research on what he told me that he was going to talk about so that I would be, you know, credible, which is great. So that is really fantastic. So Ben's parents, I don't like them. When they learned about the victim in the plane crash, how did they react? That doesn't, you know, that didn't ring true about anything. Tell us about his parents and what did they really think about Allison?
Well, I think his parents are, they only care about appearances. Like that's all they really care about. And so I think that his mother kind of liked Allison in a kind of a new pet kind of way. So I think she liked the idea of having this like pretty, you know, future daughter-in-law who she could kind of dress up and navigate in the world. But I don't think that there was any genuine grief when the plane crash happened. Like, I don't think that they felt any true sadness about what had happened to Allison. And I think that that's the thing that, you know, makes Maggie's antenna go up, is the idea that, you know, this couple was engaged and there's a plane crash and they're both, you know, presumed dead. And yet at no point does Ben's family get in touch with her. And when Maggie tries to get in touch with them, they're constantly dodging her calls. They're just obviously not interested in trying to form that relationship, which for Maggie was just like she couldn't imagine anybody reacting like that and being kind of genuine person.
You're right, because actually one of two things, either they were denying in their minds that their son was dead, or they knew something that nobody else knew, or they were just cold-hearted, and I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have Jim, who is okay, and he tries to help Maggie to find Allison. Why does he agree to help her, and yet he holds back some of the information? And then we have emails there that sort of are enlightening also.
Yeah, well, Jim is an interesting character in that he's never quite sure what his motives are. You don't know which side he's playing for. You don't know if he's genuine, and you don't know if he really is who he says he is. And so there is this idea that he's this kind of slightly like gray man character that could flip either way, and hopefully that keeps you guessing.
It did, truly. Keep everybody guessing. And yeah, if I tell you, this was so interesting, and I'm like I said, I couldn't put it down, seriously.
Oh, good. So, thank you. That's so nice.
And then lately, I've got so many books, and it doesn't happen too often. Sometimes it takes me too long. If it takes me more than a day to read a book, they're in trouble. So tell us
about
Why,
you are
Huxley.
A fast reader. You're such That's a very fast
I know. And I have someone to blame for that, my mother. She made me read like 6 to 8 books a week and takes notes besides everything else I had to do. I still do that.
God.
So if anybody saw your other copy of your book, I have the new one in front of me. If they saw the original one that they had sent, they couldn't read it if they tried, because I underlined, circled, crossed out, and put doodads in it so that I would know what I needed to write for the review. But by the time I finish doing that, I have the book memorized, so it doesn't matter. So
yeah,
tell
amazing.
Us about this company, Prexylene, and how it comes into play in this novel. And Amanda and David, those are his parents, right? His parents. But tell us about Prexylene and why is that important, that company?
So I wanted to, another thing that I wanted to kind of explore when writing this book is the kind of murky world of big pharma. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've all seen in recent years with the kind of mm-hmm. OxyContin epidemic that has ravaged the country, that there's a problem. There's a problem with pharmaceutical companies getting away with doing things that are unethical and making a lot of money while doing it. And so that was something I really wanted to explore. So the idea with Prexlane is that it's this kind of small time, like mom and pop company owned by Ben's parents. And then Ben takes it over and he focuses his research on postpartum depression, which I think is something that a lot of women struggle with and that isn't really talked about. And he sort of comes up with this miracle drug that is that will, you know, get you back on your feet in no time. And now women can have it all and all that kind of stuff that we're promised. But, you know, as with everything, if there's a magic pill, there's probably some nasty side effects or consequences. It's never as good as it seems. So that idea of there being this wonder drug that, you know, makes him and his company an absolute fortune, but has devastating consequences for some of the people who take it, is really at the heart of the kind of Prexlane thing.
I know. You know, you find that, I find it lately, when you go to any kind of medical, whether it's not my primary at all, but anybody else like an urgent care or an ER or something, they are so quick to say, do you want oxycodone or do you want Tramadol or do you want Percocet? And I say, I'll take Tylenol or Motrin, you know, if I need something. I don't believe in opiates. And if anybody's ever taken it even once, you'll know what I'm saying. It puts you in a world of you don't even want to know. You don't even feel like you belong there, as far as people that have told me they've taken it. And I go like, oh, my God, not me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And they're fast to prescribe it. As a matter of fact, they'll say to you, would you like to get a prescription to go home with? And go, I don't want it to start with anyway. No, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, ugh. So she finds a gun, and where did it come from? And who decides to help her? And she needs the rifle, and she listens to the news and learns something too. So how did that come into play? Because there was another character in there that came to help her out of nowhere.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's, you know, Allison, her journey is definitely, it's mainly her getting through on her own, but she has a couple of lucky breaks, and one of them is that when she's coming through this storm, she ends up taking refuge in this hunter's line that she finds in the middle of the woods, and underneath the floorboards, she finds that these hunters have stashed a rifle for the winter. Mm-hmm. And so she takes it. And so that then gives her a bit of agency. So it's like that, the idea is that, you know, on every step of her journey, she's kind of picking something up that might be able to help her in the future. And the rifle is one of those things. And then she, meets like a very nice stranger who helps her out when she's in a real bind. And that's another kind of idea of her being able to do this on her own, but also, you know, she needs some help along the way too.
Well, I think that if you didn't include something like that, it might not have been, you know, as realistic, because eventually, you know, sometimes you get lucky and there are nice people in the world. And then she was lucky that he wasn't crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
And make it worse. Every time she stayed at this house, at this hut, where this place, I said to my God, is someone going to come in there? Is someone going to find her? And I was glad they didn't. But she realized when she had to leave. So who is Sam and what role does he play in this particular book?
So he's like, he's just a kind of, you know, nice guy who just wants to help out. Like, I think that's the idea is that I think if you're a woman on your own, you're never really sure. There's always a kind of element of hesitation and worry that comes in. And so part of this, the book is her trying to figure out who is on her side and who is not. And Sam is, again, one of those people that you're not sure if he's on her side or not.
Yeah, that is true. Now, I know that some people think this drug was great, but what made them finally realize that it's not so great? I mean, and so many people, you know, people just want a wonder cure to make them feel better. But I wonder, I mean, even if I take, well, no matter what it is, and I don't take anything, if I took something, I would probably look on 77 sites just to find out what the side effects are and if it's worth it to even be bothered with this. Yeah, because you have to be so careful. They don't tell you that when you're getting the medicine. Oh, this is what you need to take. Just take it. Well, people shouldn't take that at face value. They got to learn, you know, not to do that.
Well, I guess this is the sort of problem that I was wanted to explore is, you know, it's like when OxyContin first came on the market and they marketed it as non-addictive. That was their whole idea was that this was something that you could take that would be non-addictive because it had this time-release coating on it. And that was a lie. Like, it was, of course, is now proven to be incredibly addictive. And, you know, the company has had to pay out a lot of money, but still made a ton of money, geez, to make a ton of money, despite the fact that it, you know, intentionally misled the public. And the same thing is happening with Prexalane's drug, where they are saying that, you know, this is a wonder drug and it has no side effects and it's going to change your life. And they're fudging the research. They're fudging the results so that they're kind of burying any nasty side effects that happen. And then they're also burying, you know, like you said, you could look it up on the internet, but they're trying to bury that stuff too. They're trying to bury any of the kind of negative feedback they're getting and the horror stories that come out of people who've taken this drug and had. So it's sort of it's really about, you know, what money can do and greed can do. And how it can mislead people.
That's scary because there are so many drugs that are out there that are dangerous. I remember they wanted my mother to take it. My mother was taking Coumadin for 51 years, and basically it did what it was supposed to do because I monitored her blood. She had Alzheimer's, so she couldn't do anything. So I made sure that I knew that, you know, when her INR was too high or whatever, the doctor worked with me, and I knew that. But all of a sudden, he wanted to put her on something else. And I looked it up, and I'm saying, if I have to make up a story, which basically I did, she's not taking Xarelto. And with Coumadin, they check your blood every 2 weeks. With Xarelto, they don't. And when I look up the side effects, they don't. Every couple of months or even at all. And it's supposed to work. And they put it back on the market because I see the commercials for it. My mother couldn't use caplets, and I couldn't open the cap because I called the company to find out if I put it in her yogurt or something because she couldn't swallow it. That took care of that. If there was a way to get around to it, I was going to find it. There's so many drugs out there that this guy, he decided that Prexalene was great, and when he realized that maybe it wasn't, it's as if he didn't care if people died. Did he? He didn't care.
All he cared about was the money. That's it.
And that's scary. Well, when you did the flashbacks to Allison, what were her strong points and her flaws? And when you get to really know her with his family, what do we really learn? Because I wanted to smack them in the head for what they were treating her. And what he thought he could do. I mean, seriously, I was getting... Now you know I really read this because I got really upset because, you know, you try to teach even young girls, this is not how you want... You don't want to be somebody's, you know, little princess or little girl on a pedestal that has no brain. Yeah. And she's not anything... She's anything but that.
I mean, I think that Allison, I think that in those flashbacks you see that... You see a couple things. You see that life has wore her down, and and wore away her confidence so that she sort of lost herself. And that's how she ends up in that relationship with him, is that she didn't really know who she was anymore following her dad's death. And as a result, he offered her a kind of life and an identity that felt solid and stable. And so that's why she ended up taking it, I think. And I think we also see that she's quite stubborn. So even though she seems malleable when she's in that relationship with Ben in the flashbacks, I think that there is also a kind of, you see kind of little flashes of her stubbornness too. And bits where you can see the resolve that will get her through the wilderness later on.
I don't know how did you create those scenes for the wilderness? I mean, there were times that I thought that she was just the quicksand and all the rest of it. I'm like, oh my God, is she going to make it? Is she going to be dead? Is she going to, you know, survive? And then I'm saying, now she's not going to not survive because Allison is Allison. So how did you create those scenes? Because I was just like heart stopping and going, okay.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I mean, I wrote actually like a lot of the wilderness section that appears in the book is a lot less than what I originally wrote. So the first draft of the book was like a lot more of her, her versus nature. And so I had, when I came down to kind of editing and cutting it and shaping it, I had a lot to draw from. Like I had a lot of material, and I just did a lot of research into, I read a lot of like firsthand accounts of people surviving in the wilderness, and I did a lot of research into the Rockies themselves and the various pitfalls that they would throw up and the challenges that they would throw up. So that was all kind of part of what went into it. And I also just basically, it was like the idea of being stranded in the Colorado Rockies with nothing is my idea of a nightmare. So I basically just thought about all the things that I would be the most afraid of, and I made her go through them.
Well, before I forget, this Thursday, it's another one of those books that came to me and I didn't know I was getting. That's what happens. And my husband looked at me I got 8 books the other day in front of
my
door.
God.
And I seriously, and I'm saying, huh? And it's like, my chair's got 22, and I actually finished like 5 this week, and I'm trying to finish all the ones for the interview. I finished all the ones for the interviews for March. I'm working on April now. The 21st, for those of you that have never read The Chef's Secret by Crystal King, it's the story of Bartholomew Scappi, the real chef, but he's not exactly the reputable person that you think he is in the book. It's fantastic. It's one of those books that, you want to read it. On Monday, we have the author of Dark Paradise. On Tuesday, this is a surprise because I didn't know I was doing it until 2 days ago, David Putnam, The Reckless. I'm like so excited. And on the 28th, we're doing a memorial special tribute with Herbie Pilato to the life of Mary Tyler Moore. Mary Tyler Moore,
nice.
The Mary Tyler Moore story. It's like, I'm so, it's exciting. On the 5th, New York Times author Barry Eisler is going to be here with Killer Captain. On the 7th, New York Times author, this is mind-boggling, Philip Margolin, The Perfect Alibi. Then another New York Times author, Brian Freeman, The Crooked Street. And then the author of Forgotten Hours, it's a debut novel, it's really good. On the 19th, Andrea Kane. On the 21st and the 26th, this is funny, sort of. Somebody put something on Facebook. I thought it was the real E. Goldberg, the one that writes Monk and Diagnosis Murder. The real E. Goldberg? Well, this was Lee Matthew Goldberg, and I had no idea. And I said, watch out, I'm reading Killer Thriller. It wasn't him. It was somebody else. So I'm interviewing and he wrote a book called The Desire Card. It's fantastic. So I went and he gave me permission to print it out because he doesn't have any copies, and I felt bad. But on the 26th, the real E. Goldberg is coming on. And 11 o'clock, I was like, I can't believe I did that. But, you know, when Fran says she's going to do something, she's going to do it. So the other thing is that I helped my niece write a term paper, so I helped all my nieces do something. We did one on e-cigs and FDA approval. Mm-hmm. How does the FDA come into play with this particular drug? And tell us about Anthony. Why is it sometimes that they skirt the issue and they, you know, approve these drugs? Don't they read that there's side effects and they could kill people?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what – I don't know the kind of ins and outs of the FDA's decision-making process, but I think that part of it – I mean, it must be time constraints, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I would imagine there's, like, an element of pressure to get drugs on the market, and I think that sometimes, you know, you just never know, like, in terms of how well – you know, what the kind of research is, how long the – the samples go, the sample testing goes on for. So I think that there are, you know, there's always room for a margin for error, I guess, in everything. But yeah, I don't know how exactly the FDA makes their decisions in terms of what comes to market and what doesn't and how rigorously they're researched. You would hope, you know, very, very rigorously.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wonder sometimes because, I mean, I don't know if they even realize that there are side effects. And I wonder what would happen if somebody in the FDA actually took the drug and figured out, oh, my God, I don't want to take that. That's dangerous. I don't know. I often wonder.
I mean,
it's scary.
Well, I think there is a process that they have to go through to get a drug to market. And if you look at it, it does seem like it's quite rigorous. You know, there. But I guess it's one of those things where, with everything, you know, how long do they run these tests for? Is it for 6 months? Is it for a year? You know, what if the side effects only show up after 10 years? Do they hold the drug back from the market if it could theoretically help a lot of people to make sure that there are no side effects? So I think that there's always an element of risk. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes big pharma can manipulate those drug trials and those results so that you don't fully see the side effects when you're first prescribed the drug.
I agree. I mean, I looked at, you know, my nephew was taking something the other day for something, nothing major. And I said to my niece, look it up and see the side effects before you get it. Otherwise, use this as over the counter and it's not going to hurt him. It's dangerous. They just absolutely know nowhere. That they really realize this. So, I mean, even pharmacists are supposed to legally, when you get an opiate or a specific new drug, new antibiotic or something, they're supposed to come over and tell you, you know, this is what's going to happen or not. And also they're supposed to make sure that you understand when to take it if you've never taken it before and where it interacts. If you're taking other medications, they're supposed to see if you can take it or not. Which doesn't always happen. It did. That did happen when my former pharmacist was there, which he would say, you can't take that. You're allergic to codeine. I go, yeah, no, I wouldn't take it anyway because I wasn't planning on it ever. Seriously.
It goes back to human error again, right? So I guess that, like, you know, you just have to hope that you get a doctor or a pharmacist who's going to give you as much information. And I think that the vast majority of, you know, medical professionals will do that. But there is always this element of human error that comes into play.
That's so true, because somebody wanted me to take something specific, nothing major, an antibiotic. And I'm saying, I could swear there's sulfa in there. And they go, not sure. I looked it up and found it. I said, it's right there. And and they didn't think it was a major factor. The pharmacist didn't either. I said, well, you know what? Call the physician because I'm not taking it because I know better and I've had a reaction to it before. You got to be careful. So the other thing that surprised me was the memorial for Ben. Why do we get a feeling that the parents were just like, they just did it? Why? I mean, it just seemed that they're so cold. I don't like them at all, really.
They're not very nice people. I guess the memorial for Ben is, again, that kind of idea of, like, they're wanting to it's about appearance, right? So they would, of course, want to do something that shows, that is a big kind of display of their their love without any real human feeling behind it. So I think that that's like another element of them, yeah, as you say, being quite cold and being very like appearance driven rather than genuine.
I know, and they really didn't. You know, I read this scene about how they described Allison and how they really feel about her, and really they need her to be locked someplace else, far away. Because I really see, I mean, they literally thought they were going to mold her and made her feel like nobody. I wonder, and Ben probably felt the same way. I'm surprised that they didn't just do a prearranged marriage and pick somebody for him that they approved of and probably wouldn't have approved. I don't think they would approve of anybody for him.
There was definitely a thing, I think, especially with his mother, where she felt like there was nobody who was going to be good enough. You know, they held him up on a pedestal for sure. And I think that that's why you got this sense, hopefully, of, you know, of Allison struggling to kind of fit into that family, but not quite feeling at home or feeling comfortable and knowing that it wasn't right, but not being able to do anything about it.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, and I've known people like that. Well, oh, nobody's good enough for my son. He's perfect. Meanwhile, he hasn't got the intelligence of an elbow. Seriously. and I've heard situations where parents have literally paid someone to marry their daughter because no one was going to accept her, but a large sum of millions might help.
Oh,
I mean, it's true fact. Yeah, it's scary. It's like, oh, my God. Anyone that needs to be paid to marry you, you ditch them before you even start. I mean,
yeah,
seriously.
Yeah, you don't want to marry somebody who has to be paid to be married to you. That's not a good start in life, I don't think. Yeah.
Well, unless you're desperate, who knows? So there's another character. I'm just looking at the book. It's staring in front of me. What part does Liz play with Allison when she speaks to her?
She's sort of like, I saw her sort of as like almost like a big sister sort of figure in her life, where she's a bit older and, you know, has lived in this world that Ben lives in for a long time. And that I wanted to have Allison have an ally, or what she perceived as an ally in that world that she felt like she could talk to and open up to. So that was the idea, is that she's almost a kind of big sister figure.
Well, so everybody needs somebody that they can trust. But I learned a long time ago, and I think Allison knows, that the best person you can trust is yourself. Because if you're not sure, that's what came through to this. Now, I'm not going to say the ending, because the ending was however it was. But Maggie doesn't give up at all. And yet, if Maggie could say something at this point to Allison, what would she say to her if she gets to see her again? How would she? Can she mend the relationship? Can she mend the rift between them? Or would that take like another book?
I think that the rift can be mended, and I think that there were faults on both sides, I think, that led to that rift. I think that there was like stubbornness that happened on both Maggie and Allison's part. And I think that both of them were sort of unwilling to see the other person's point of view. And I think that Maggie definitely, both of them really, along their journeys, hopefully learned to kind of look outside of themselves and to widen their perspective a little bit and to realize that, like, you don't always have to agree with everything that somebody does to love them and to be close to them. And I think that's the main thing, is that I think that both of them were a little bit too quick to judge each other, and that ended up putting a barrier between them that they couldn't overcome without some greater thing bringing them together.
Now, if anybody realized that they were fudging the results, and I'm sure they do today anyway, and they found out, would they do anything about it? Would they arrest the person? Could they prove it? And what if Ben says, no, there's no problem? But yet there were emails here and there that they realized that there were problems, which they didn't ignore. So how does that work with the law? Would they do something about it?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, that's definitely like, it's like, it's, there have definitely been cases in the past where pharmaceutical companies have been shown to be criminally negligent in terms of either withholding information or doctoring research. So certainly, Ben, if all of that came to light in a court of law, I would imagine there would be, you know, there's the chance that he could go to jail.
That's if they catch him and he doesn't have enough power or money behind the person. That's what gets me sometimes, is that there are people we know, we listen to the news every day, that have enough money or clout that they get away with the nonsense that they're pulling. And then even when people investigate them, it doesn't really matter. It bothers me. I listen to the news a lot. And my problem is, because I read so much, I see past what's on the page. So I see past what they're trying to say sometimes, and which is good, because I blame that on the professor that I had for my second master's in reading. He taught me how to look past the page and look into the deep structure of the novel or a book and get what the author's trying to say. So I just hope I get it. So,
yeah.
Anthony is a drug rep for Prexylene, whatever. So how does he come into play in this particular book?
So he, I think he actually works for the FDA. So he's a whistleblower that side of things. So I think that's the, you know, to your question as to whether or not anything would actually happen. And if somebody saw something like this happening and uncovered it, would they speak up? I think the answer is some people would and some people wouldn't. It depends on the person, and it depends, because obviously, like, being a whistleblower comes with an amount of personal sacrifice, and certainly it did for Anthony. And so I think that there's always a price that you pay if you're going to be the person who speaks up against injustice, particularly in the face of this big kind of corporate monster.
Well, it could get dangerous too, seriously. You just don't know. You could get dangerous for the whistleblower. And I've read books based on that. I've read everything. It's really, I don't know. So, I've read everything, just about. The only thing that I won't read is porn or erotica. I will not read that.
Huh.
They sent me the most famous one, and I shared it with other people, and I didn't read it. I don't read stuff like that. And the other thing is, it has to take a lot out of me to read self-help. And
okay.
I just did, and I will not say. The title is called WTF, Wrong With Our Health System, and it's not what you think, it's what's wrong with food. And it was kind of comical, it was interesting, yeah. And I'm doing one on April 17th with a young man who's 28 or 29, that has Asperger's Syndrome Spectrum, and Dylan Volk he's going to talk about his ailment. And how it feels to have Asperger's.
Wow.
I just interviewed his father, and I'm reading his book next. It should be interesting because he speaks his mind.
Yeah.
What can I say? So, before we begin, are you going to do a sequel to this? Are you going to bring Allison back at all? Or are we done with her?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm done. I mean,
okay.
I feel done now. And the book I'm writing next is completely different. I mean, it's like has similar themes, and that it's about, like, you know, it's hopefully like page turning, and it's about strong women and the relationship between these two women. So there's like a kind of similar vibe going on, but it's not a sequel or anything. It's completely different characters, completely different setting. So right now I think Maggie and Allison are retired for now.
Okay, when is this book coming out so I know when Heather's going to send it? Because I know she's going to send it. I mean, I don't even ask anymore. I just like, yeah. I mean, it's the same thing when I got Verses of the Dead. They asked me 7 times, did you get the book? And I think I'm glad I did. I go, and he was amazing, Douglas Preston. But
yeah.
I was like, okay,
yeah.
When is this coming out? Just so I have an idea.
I think it will be January next year. That's the idea. If I can get my, hopefully I'm finishing the first draft at the end of this month. And so then the ball can get rolling on it. So that's the idea.
Oh, that's fantastic. Cause I'm sure by January of next year, they'll have a whole bunch of them. And I have to make sure that I put it in my schedule. Do you
yes.
ever come Do you ever come to the Thriller Fest in New York? With all the
new
mystery thriller writers?
I don't, but I am, is it? Oh, good. I'm relocating for a year to Maine, actually, in a month's time. So I'm moving back from London after 15 years of living in UK. My husband and I are going to move to America for a little while. So maybe then, maybe once I'm in place, then I'll go along.
Well, they actually, I don't get paid to do book reviews, people, ever. And I don't get paid for my radio show, except if it comes through a specific blog tour. Sometimes I'll charge like a nominal fee because I do a lot of work, but, you know, now not everybody. And I don't get paid. I do have a magazine that just came out 2 weeks ago, MJ12. My sister passed away, so I named it after her, Marcia Joyce, MJ12. And it's for writers, readers, anybody that wants to write articles for the April edition. I'm looking for anything that's controversial, writing tips, publishing, political ideas, political issues, anything. The last issue was writers all over the world, young writers that wrote book reviews. And there were kids that wrote book reviews ages 10 to 19, and then some of the authors had grandsons and children that wrote. The magazine came out fantastic. I was really proud
of
it. Yeah, and it's
really
called
cool.
MJ Magazine, and this is 12 issues. I'm hoping to do like another one or two with them. So before we end, where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And you have to come because I get invited. That's the only thing that I get, that my perk of doing what I do. The people that run the Thriller Fest, Kimberly Howe and John Land, they invite me because I do this. So I get to meet everybody.
That's cool.
I'll
definitely try to come.
It's exciting to be in the same room with Nelson DeMille. I love him. He's so nice. Armand Stein, all of them. I mean, you know, and sometimes I get brave and I walk up and I go, "Hi, it's me. How are you?" And they go, "Oh, I have my book for you." It makes you feel good. So where can we find
it's
out
really
about
cool.
you and your work?
So I'm on Twitter, but I'm not very good at tweeting, I have to say. I'm a very bad tweeter. But I am on Twitter, and I think it's Jessica Berry Author is my Twitter handle. And then I'm also on Instagram, which I think I'm more active on, which is just Jessica Berry and then the number 9. And that is mainly pictures of my cats, but they're extremely adorable. And I'm always happy to hear from anybody. I've actually really enjoyed engaging with the, because there's a lot of like really nice book Instagram people out there. So it's been really fun with this book to kind of talk to them and have a chat about Free Fall. So yeah, please do get in touch with me on there.
Well, I'll let everybody know that. I put your review on my Facebook wall just now too. And
thank
I put
you.
It out on my Just Review. The minute, it's amazing, the minute I post something, like 10 people read it. It's scary.
Oh, how nice.
And
that's cool.
And actually, I have the one with me. I gave the other one away, the good one away, that I didn't write in to the lady in my building who takes all my books. But this one I'm holding because my dermatologist loves me because I bring him books. Not because I have to see him, but because every so often I'll call and go, "Do you need reading material?" He goes, "You know, you never have to wait for an appointment because you bring me reading material." I go, like, "I don't have to see you, but I'll bring you reading material." He loves me. See, this book is going on the side of his next pile. So I want to thank
you
so much, and I can't wait. Do you ever do panel shows? Because I've done them with strong male characters, and I'm thinking about doing one maybe in June with strong female characters. So
that would be great.
So I'll get in touch with Heather and tell her, because I know that
perfect.
John Land has Caitlin Strong, and Mark Greeny has Zoya. There's a whole bunch of strong female characters, and friends read them all.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's a great idea.
So
that'd be a really fun panel.
I don't know how it is by you. The sun might come out. It's been like raining and snowing. They're expecting a snowstorm on Wednesday, which I just adore, the fact that we're going to snow. But I want to thank you so very much. Everybody have a great day.
Me.
Jessica, thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Bye. Thank you.